Thank you, Steve. And thank you, as always, to Zeifman's for hosting. So this is actually a first for Terchiner and me. Normally, our Beit Midrash, our organization, has two components. We have our internal study, where we, among ourselves, we study a tractate of Talmud, and then we educate throughout the community in different topics. And the things that we get to study in our own time, obviously we have much more time to really delve into it and flesh out all the details, because we're not constrained by the 45 minutes, by the hour that we give the lecture. But last year, Terchiner and I decided that we wanted, since we do discuss a lot, we spend a lot of our public lectures on business ethics, we wanted to take a section of the Talmud that discussed these laws, that we would have the time to really flesh these ideas out for ourselves before we presented them publicly. So for the first 6 months of the year, we were studying the laws of price controls and overcharging in the Talmud. So that's what this series came out of. So the question I want to deal with, as the title says, is, are price controls relevant anymore? So in the Torah, in Jewish law, there are two related concepts, just as a background, that we need to understand. One law that's relevant is called ona'ah. It's called, literally it means oppression. It's loosely translated as overcharging. Neither of those really capture the nature of the Talmudic law. Basically, it goes as follows. It prohibits deceptive overcharging or underpaying. That's the simple translation. We'll see the details in a minute. Meaning, if you have a case where someone says, I understand that this is worth $100, but I'm going to pay $1,000 for it, so that's not going to fall under the normal rules of ona'ah, because everything is above board. The normal laws of ona'ah are deceptive overcharging or underpaying. Again, we'll see the details in a moment. What? Deceptive, right? The key being there, deceptive, and we'll see that just in a minute. The second law we're going to have to deal with is what's called hafkat sha'arim, which is price manipulation, which is, right, the first law assumes a price and says that once there is a price, you can't overcharge from that price, whatever it is, or underpay from that price, whatever it is. The second law is that you can't manipulate the markets such that the prices change. Right? Now, let's say you did manipulate the market, right? There were, there was a monopoly that decided to drive the price up, and then you charge the new price, right? That would not be a problem of ona'ah, because at this point, that is the price. The potential problem is hafkat sha'arim, is that to get to that new price, you manipulated the market. So those are the two laws we need to keep in mind. And the question I want to ask is, first of all, the first law, ona'ah, it assumes a price. So what does that even mean in a modern economy, right? Is there such a thing as a price? Right? In order to say you have deceptive overcharging, there needs to be a price that sets the bar. Is there such a thing as a price in a modern economy where you could have the exact same item produced by the same, parent company, whatever company it is that owns Gap, Banana Republic, and Old Navy, right? Can make the same shirt, you put Old Navy on it, it costs $10, you put Gap, it costs $20, you put Banana Republic, it costs $40, and yet everybody understands that, and anyone who wants to buy from Banana Republic so they can say Banana Republic, and everyone knows they didn't buy it at Old Navy, right? They pay $40 for basically the same T-shirt, but they do it, and yet we know that that's just part of modern economy. So is there even such a thing as a price such that we can begin to talk about the laws of ona'ah, deceptive overcharging? And then the second question is, even if there isn't, right, even if there isn't set prices, how exactly do we relate to the second thing, which is, okay, there are relative prices, so maybe the laws of overcharging are hard to apply, but under what circumstances can we not manipulate prices? Are we limited from manipulating prices? Yeah?
Self-suggested retail, simple as that. And then if Trump suggests retail, you can go any direction you want. But every manufacturer or whatever...
Right, so as we'll see, some people will say that there is such a thing as a price, and maybe suggested retail is a good example of what a price would mean, but that's what we're going to have to see. So this is the journey we're gonna go through. Okay? So it all starts with a verse in number 2. The background is as follows. There is a law, there's a series of laws that relate to what's known as the Jubilee year, the Yovel. One of the laws is as follows. Traditionally, biblical Israel was divided into ancestral lands by tribe and then subdivided by family and by individuals. So, you know, you, let's say, you had a house which you'd inherited from your father and his father's father, and it'd been in your family for forever. The law is that God didn't want Israel, biblical Israel, to lose that family identity, that tribal identity. So there is no such thing as eternal sale of land in Israel, for the most part, except for in walled cities, but that's a different story. For the most part, you can't sell land forever. If you sell land, it's really just a lease until the year of the Yovel. So if you sell at the beginning of the Yovel is every 50th year, so it's a 50-year cycle. If you sell in year one of the Yovel, so what you're doing is you're selling your property, you're not selling it, you're leasing it for 50 years. So let's say you leased it for $1 million. So then what that really means is that you are leasing it for a rent of $20,000 a year. Now, people are allowed to redeem it, right? The family member, either the person himself or his family, are allowed to redeem that land in the middle of the Yovel cycle. But the way you do it is, let's say it was 50 years, so it was $20,000 a year. We'll make it easy. 25 years in, the person inherits money from somewhere else, makes it in the stock market, suddenly has the money to buy back his ancestral land. He comes back to you, or to your child, or whoever is now in control of this land and says, I want it back. So they say to you, well, that's fine. We bought it until the Yovel for 50 years, $1 million. You're redeeming it after 25 years. Therefore, in order to redeem it, you got to pay half the price. You got to pay $500,000, then you can redeem it. And that's how it would work. So there's a very, very set price per year for that land. Parenthetically, in modern Israel, not as far as I know for halachic reasons, 85% of the land is the same way. You can't buy most land in Israel. When you buy a house, quote unquote, what you really get is a 99-year lease from the Israel Land Authority. And then in theory, though the country hasn't been around long enough to see what will actually happen at the end of this lease, theoretically, at the end of that 99 years, you either give it back to the government or you pay more to extend your lease on the land. So in that context, the Torah says as follows in number two, b'mispar shanim achar yovel. So in those years after the yovel, tiknem eid amitecha, so you will buy it back, b'mispar shanim achar yovel, right, based on the number of years left to the crop years, I mean the number of years you can harvest this land, I mean the number of years left to yovel, that's going to be the price. Lefi rova shanim tarbe miknato, lefi ma'oda shanim tamid miknato. The more years you get, the higher the price, the less the price. Because what he's really selling you is he's leasing you the land for X number of harvestable years. And in that context, we say, and do not oppress, do not overcharge, do not wrong your friend, and fear God, for I am the Lord your God. So in that context, the Torah tells you, don't oppress someone else. Don't overcharge or underpay for that land. Now, how much is considered overcharging? And is it a penny, right? If it's a penny over, so now you return the land. So the Talmud says no. The Mishnah number three says, Ha'ona'a, what does it mean to overcharge? Arba kesef. Me'esrim v'arba kesef l'sela shtut l'mekach. The laws of overcharging are 1/6. 4 silver for a price of 24 silver, meaning 1/6 of the purchase. What does that mean? The laws of overcharging are 1/6. So the Talmud explains in number 4, in Amarava, Hilchata pachot mishtut nikne mekach, yoter al shtut bitul mekach, shtut kano machter na. There are 3 levels. So now let's move away from land. Let's just take an easy number here. Let's say you buy, I don't know, you buy a, whatever. You buy a phone for $600, okay? $600 would be an easy number to work with, okay? If it's worth $600 and you are charged $700, ring 1/6 more, so if it's exactly 1/6, so the law is that the sale stands, but you have to return that $100. So in the end, if A sold to B the phone for $700. The phone will stay in the hands of B, but he'll have to return $100. In the end of the day, A will have $600 and B will have the phone. right? That's how it's going to work, right? That's if it's exactly 1/6. If it's less than a sixth, meaning it's worth $600 and you charge $650, so even though you shouldn't have done that, or we'll see that in a moment, even though let's assume you shouldn't have done that, the sale stands, there's nothing you can do, okay? So the price of that phone should have been $600. A sold it for $650 to B. B keeps his phone, and he can't get the money back. We'll just get the third one out. If it was a $600 phone and it was sold for $800, so then the whole sale is invalid, and you give back the phone, you give back the money, and you got to start again. Okay? That's the simple laws of Onaa. Exactly a sixth, the sale stands, you return the overcharge. Less than a sixth, there's nothing you can do. More than a sixth, the entire sale collapses. Yeah.
Is there a time limit?
Yes. There is a time limit. And I didn't put the full discussion of it, but the simplest formulation of the Mishnah is the amount of time that the person has to show it to an expert and figure out that he was overcharged. And if at such point he either shows it to someone or has the ability to and doesn't care, so then we move on. But that's the basic law. Now, there is a discussion. Let's say that, so as I mentioned, if it's $650 for the 600 phone, right, you charge $650, so it's clear that the sale stands. But was it permitted, meaning ethically, ritually, was the person allowed to charge the extra $50, and it's just that, or is it that you're not allowed to do it, there's nothing you can do about it, right? Those are the two options, right? If you charge less than 1/6 over, so it's either the reason we can't do anything is because it was permitted, you're allowed to charge $50 more than the going price, or is it, no, you're never allowed to charge more than the going price. It's just that if you charge too little more than the going price, so we just can't do anything about it. We let it go. You deal with it with God after you pass away, but the courts aren't going to get involved. So that's a discussion in number 5. Rabbeinu Asher, writing in the 13th century in Germany and then in Spain, deals with this, and he assumes that it is probably forbidden. That even less than a sixth, you can't abuse someone else, you can't charge him extra, even less, even a minimal amount. But up to 1/6, we won't do anything about it, because that happens. Right? The prices vary a little bit. That's the Rush's assumption. Shulchan Aruch in number 6 notes that it's not so clear, right? It could go either way, right? It's uncertain whether it's permitted to overcharge less than 1/6 if it is more than a pruta, I mean more than a minimal amount, okay? So again, where we stand so far is if you have the $600 phone, if you charge $800 for it, the sale collapses. If you charge $700 exactly, the sale stands, but you return the $100 overcharge. If it's $650, so the sale stands, and then we're not sure whether it was actually permitted to charge $650, or you weren't allowed to do it, but once you did it, we're not going to get involved. It's too little for the courts to care. You'll take it up with God, and that's it. But that's the basic law of overcharging. I should just note, I'm going to use overcharging the whole time because it'll get too confusing. The same thing is true of underpaying. Right, all these laws are equally true. The opposite, right? The same thing would be true if the phone was a $600 phone and you paid $500, right? If it was $500, so now it's 1/6. You have to pay back the $100, and the sale stands. If it was $450, then the sale would collapse. If it was $550, so then the sale would stand and you wouldn't return any money. So it's the exact same thing. Underpaying, we're just going to go with overcharging. Those are the basic laws of overcharging. Now, as we mentioned, while Ona'a is really generally translated as overcharging, it's a mistake because it's deceptive overcharging. Because if it's a $600 phone and I go to the store and he says, look, it's $600, but I'm charging you $700, take it or leave it. So that's not Ona'a. That is permitted, right? Ona'a is only where it was either deceptive or mistaken overcharging. Now, obviously, if it was a mistake, so between you and God, you're fine. You didn't sin, but you only sin if you did it on purpose. But still, the basic law is the same, and that's what the Rambam says in number 7: that one who engages in commerce honestly has no onah against him. Right? There is no claim of onah if you did this honestly. How so? If you say, "I bought this item for X and I will have Y profit," there is no onah against him. Just say, "I'm overcharging you. Deal with it." right? That's all there is to it, right? That's going to be the price. You can do what you want. You don't have to buy it, right? There is no law of onah. It's only in cases of deceptive overcharging. Now, one more caveat, and this I'm just putting in here, but we're going to come back to this in the third week of this series, is the laws of onah don't apply to everything. They only apply to chattel. They only apply to movable items, a phone, a book, maybe a car, let's assume a car, but not to real estate, not to sacred items, not to a series of things are brought in the Mishnah that doesn't apply to. What we're going to talk about in 2 weeks is land. I think we called it the Toronto housing bubble or something like that, right? Housing is an interesting case where it doesn't really apply. Though, if you look at number 8, right, Yeshua Falk just notes that when we say it doesn't apply, it doesn't mean it's not forbidden. Again, it just means that we can't do anything about it, right? If you overcharge, the house was $1 million, you charge $2 million, there's nothing we can do about it. It's still forbidden to do that, but we're going to bracket that for 2 weeks from now. Okay. The problem is that all of this assumes, right, with all the caveats, right, that it doesn't apply to real estate and that it only applies, you know, that it only applies when it's dishonest and not when you're above board. All these laws still assume one thing, right? Overcharging assumes that there is a price from which you're overcharging. Now, in the context in the Torah, that makes sense, right? What was the context in the Torah? The Torah context was, I sold my land for $1 million for 50 years. I want to redeem it after 25 years. I know exactly how much money that land is worth, not in an objective sense, but in the context of this sale, I paid $1 million, so I paid $20,000 a year. I'm redeeming it 25 years in. It's $500,000, right? The price is very, very clear, not because of the price may have changed, right? But that's not relevant here. The laws of redemption of ancestral property assume that the only thing that's relevant is the sale price that you actually sold it for, right? So there's a very clear price, and that's why it's very easy to talk about the laws of onah, the laws of overcharging, in this clear-cut way, because, well, there's a clear-cut price, right? The price was $500,000. So add a 6, subtract a 6, figure out what the number is, apply the laws. You have a very simple rubric, and that's it. Yeah?
If you were to become aware as the owner of the land, like the ancestral owner of the land, that you now can get $2 million on a rental of that land, it's appropriate to go to the guy and say, here's your $500,000.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a discussion in and of itself, but yeah, it seems to be, right? You can do whatever you want. It's your land. You have the right to do that.
The value of the land has changed.
Yeah.
It will have changed.
Right. So again, why we don't impose a current market value on that is an interesting question.
Yeah.
And again, we're going to get to land in 2 weeks, but the assumption is that we're working within the actual price of the sale, right? The original price of the sale, and that's the benchmark for all future interactions over this piece of land. So the price is set. Now, in the ancient market, it was also true that this wasn't just true of your land. This was true of most things, right? It wasn't really, right? Yeah, not everything, but yeah.
Talking about seems somewhat inequitable to the buyer, subject to the circumstances. If you take, like, for example, Joseph Green, let's say someone is not going to typically sell their rights to family land for a period of time unless they can't use it for some reason, or they need something.
Or they need money, right.
They need money. So, you know, even if fair price is set at that particular date, let's say there's a famine, let's say there's drought, and someone purchased the rights to the land for 50 years, or 49 years, whatever the appropriate period is. If in that, let's say, the first 10 years, out of that first 10 years, the person who rents the land is basically plowing money into it, no pun intended, fertilizer, whatever else he has to do to maintain that property, and he doesn't really have cash crops to speak of. And then, in the 8th, 9th, and 10th year, things start turning around.
Right, so there are...
Wants to buy it back.
Right.
So now, all of a sudden, then the project off of that land, when he leased it, he probably took into consideration that there would be yield.
Right. So there is a lot of discussion. There's a whole tractate devoted to, or parts of a whole tract of Erechin devoted to this. One is, yes, this is all for the advantage of the seller. That's clear, because we want people to keep their ancestral land. So it is a bit unfair. But two is that, no, there is a discussion, because, right, this key over here, where it's not, the verses don't actually say years. They say shnei tvuot, right, the years of yields, right, the years of produce. There is a bit of discussion what exactly that means, and what limitations are placed on the sale to make it fair, because of, right, you know, what if you haven't gotten a chance to harvest yet, right? You've only been planting for 3 years, right? You've made the, you know, ready, right? There is such a discussion, and again, we'll have to come back to the specifics of land. But you're right. I mean, basically, it's to the disadvantage of the buyer, though not, right? There are some limitations on that at that disadvantage, but fundamentally, yes. Okay. But all of this assumes pricing. Right? Now, in the ancient market, we know that this makes sense, because, I mean, what was a market, right? How far did you travel? The average person, right, he was buying the things either in his town or maybe in the local market, right? Like the central hub of a city surrounded by a bunch of little towns. But besides the actual merchants, how far were you traveling, right, for a market? So it was very easy to define a market, right? The market was whatever the price was in your area, right? Your little town, your little city. But that was it, right? The fact that the Talmud is aware of the fact that there are different prices in different markets across the ocean, but it doesn't matter, because the price is whatever realistically you, the buyer and seller, are going to charge, right? Whatever the price is in your little five block village, right? That's it, right? So you're in Israel. So, I don't know, bananas are not grown locally, so if you imported them, they would be expensive, right? But, you know, grapes are local, so they're going to be cheaper. If you go, you know, to somewhere where bananas are grown naturally, so the price there will be cheaper for bananas, and the grapes don't go there, so grapes will be more expensive, whatever, right? The market is whatever it is.
If you have three people selling grapes in your market, are they going to all be selling at the same price?
So, what seems to be is that basically, give or take, that seems to be the description of the Talmud, is that yes, and the truth is if you read the descriptions in like Diocletian, right, that's true in the Roman markets also, that basically the price is pretty set, right? All grape sellers are selling, again, you know, if you have better quality, so, you know, if you want to sell for more, you will be the one who sells better quality. But the price...
Well, it's a reasonable assumption.
Yeah,
if you're selling more than the other two guys, you're not going to have...
Money. Right, I mean, remember, if the whole market...
More than the other two guys, why would you want to do that?
You know, this isn't...
So the market will kind of force, in a small market like that, will force everyone...
There'll be a small range, right? Because what are you going to do, right? If the guy next door is selling it for significantly cheaper, the guy's not going to buy from you. So, you know, you'll have all types of, you know, I'll deliver it to your house, right? I'll, whatever, I have better quality grapes. I have whatever. But basically, the Talmud talks all the time about what's called a shar, a price. Right, and there's this notion of yatsa hashar, that the prices have equalized, right? The price have normalized, right? There was clearly a period where things were a bit, you know, the beginning of the season when we didn't know how much there would be in the market, we didn't know how much would be imported, we didn't know how it would be harvested, but there was a point in the market where the Talmud called it yatsa hashar. The price is now known, right? We know what the price will be in the market season, and basically that was the price. Yeah.
I don't think this would apply if there was more, unless there was four or five dealers in the market that were selling the same produce. I don't think this can apply at all. Unless there's collusion between them, it doesn't matter. He can raise 500%. It makes no difference. The person has five people to buy.
Well, remember, we haven't gotten to Hafkat Sharim yet. Right? So far, we haven't gotten to the question of manipulation. We've only said, assuming there is one set price, right, which is not unreasonable because that would eventually happen, right, about, right? So then we apply the laws of Ona. Yeah.
Competition. I can give you the example of the grapes. Let's say there are three grape merchants. Okay? Let's say there's a population, the whole concept of supply and demand. If there happens to be somebody that sells it for, let's say, $10 a pound, and there
1,000 people that are potentially going to buy it. Okay, and there's enough grapes for 800 people. Okay? If the first two people sell their grapes, and now all of a sudden there's twice as much demand 2 seconds later after the first two sell it as there was initially, does that person, that third person, that third vendor, who now hadn't sold his grapes, have a right
of course. So of course, but realistically, now you're right, it can happen, and there are examples. There are examples where it happens. But remember, in a small market, right, the chances that there's going to be a surprise 1,000 people buying grapes, especially when you don't have storage, right, you don't have refrigeration, right? People bought slowly. So normally, what happened? Again, what the Talmud describes normally happened, and this normally what happened in the ancient markets, right, is that the price was one thing at the beginning of the market when there was a lot. Either as soon as the first crops came in and there was a lot of stuff on the market, so the price was cheap. Towards the end of the season, as supply went down, demand went up, right? So price went up. Normally, it didn't happen overnight. And yes, the price was one thing at the beginning of the market and something else at the end of the market. Again, we hadn't gotten to price changing. Right, we've just said that there was a price, right, and that you couldn't overcharge from that price. We haven't yet talked about how the price got that way, and that's where we're getting. But yes, if in theory, and now you have cases like this, right, the Talmud discusses what happens if there was a famine, right? This is the Talmud's example where the price changed overnight. It's not where 1,000 people surprised come in and want grapes. The Talmud usually discusses the opposite. What happens if you sold wheat during a famine and you didn't realize that there were 10 ships bringing wheat just right outside the right beyond your sight on the shore, and then the next day the price shoots down, right? So Thomas said that's fine as long as you didn't know, right? As long as you sold because there was a famine, that's fine. If you knew that people were buying at breakfast for dinner, and by lunchtime, right, there was going to be an influx of wheat, so you're selling it at a false price, right? Because you have information that the price really should be lower, so that's already a problem. But assuming you didn't know, you just sold it, and the next day, surprise, 10 shiploads of wheat came in, so yeah, the price changes, and the guy who waited to sell till Wednesday, right, instead of selling on Tuesday, that's fine, the price just changed. But again, this only highlights the problem here, and this is what I'm getting at, is that even in the ancient world, prices changed, and it was hard to fully define the price, but it was a bit easier because your market was a few blocks, of central marketplace. Everybody knew what was going on. Everyone knew the circumstances. The price was basically predictable. Fast forward to 2017. And what is a price? Right, if I asked you, even try to define a price for me. Right, so I gave you the example of the Banana Republic, Gap, Old Navy t-shirt. But fine. It's the same item, but there's the price that if you go into the store, there's the price if you buy it online, there's the price if you buy it during sale week, there's a price if you buy it normally, there's a price if you buy it with a, there's a price if you buy it, if you're buying by people who aren't paying taxes, there's a different price if you're paying cash or you're paying credit card, right? We can come up with all types of things. And where are you ordering it from? Maybe you're ordering it from Canada because you want to pay in the Canadian dollar, but maybe the price is cheaper in the States and you're going to the States anyway, so you're going to order it to your relative in the States because the price is lower, right? Do you factor in the price of gas that it's taking you to get to the States? What if you order it from China, right, where shipping was $100 for the phone, but the phone was $3, right? That's so the price, right? We live in an international world. Not only that, right? Pull out, I'm sure half of you have on your phone what's it called, the app, right, that compares prices so that you can, what's it called?
Flip,
right? So you can go into Sobeys and say, hey, right, grapes are at $3.99 a pound here, and they're $4.99 a pound at they're $2.99 a pound at whatever, it's so at No Frills, right? It used to be you'd at least have to drive from one to the other. Now you don't have to do that. They have price match, right? Sobeys doesn't have price match. I don't know, right? Okay, fine. I'm not an expert at Flip, but I know whenever I order anything online, right? That's what I do, right? I don't even have to do anything, right? I have an app. It automatically finds me the coupons. It does price compare. I press the button, and the next thing I know, I have a $10 off on my sale, or it directs me to a different, what is a price, right, nowadays, right? And we can go on with the examples, right? A bottle of water at the supermarket is 20 cents, at the little market on the store is a dollar, in the vending machine is $1.50, and at the bowl game is $5, right? We understand that markets, the prices, just, what is a price? So this was a problem that the modern authorities were faced with. Yeah?
I thought something like Amazon, where there could be a numerous number of vendors for the same
right,
product.
Or even on Amazon, that just emphasizes, you look on it. Yeah.
Potential buyer, he has full disclosure sheet of all of these prices.
Right, right, that just highlights the problem.
And the difference in price could be 50 or 100%.
It could be thousands of percent, right?
Under the circumstances, this becomes irrelevant.
Ah. So that's the question. And if you look at number 9, right, the rush already, again, we saw this 13th century, noted that overcharging only applies to an object that has a known value, and either the buyer or seller overcharged or underpaid. Now, the rush, I assume, 700 years ago, assumed that most things had prices, and some things maybe didn't have prices. But in our market, as we've just, all these examples highlight, what is a price? So you ask me, my intuition is yes. Take all these laws, forget about them. They only applied when there was such a thing as a price. But what is a price in 2017? Right? I couldn't tell you. Right? I have no idea. What is the price for a T-shirt? I don't know. Right? I know more or less what I'm going to get if I go into a specific store. But just walk down Yorkdale, right? Saying, you know, you could go to three stores owned by the same people, right, in the same building, get basically the same product at three different prices, and no one blinks an eye. Right? So what is a market? What is a price? So Rusher Weiss says what I would have said, which is, yeah, there is no price, period, end of story, forget it, right? We'll go to the English here, number 10. Rusher Weiss is a leading authority living now in Jerusalem, and he writes, in many things sold nowadays, it is very difficult to establish a set price. Even an upper and lower limit cannot be established exactly. The economy is so dynamic. And there is always someone who will sell cheaper, almost at a loss. On the other hand, one who will sell at an expensive price. And since one can go from one end of the earth to the other, that should be in little time, and communication is so advanced, and one can order things to his house by phone, this is very funny, or other means. So you have to remember that there's a, just for people who understand internal, like, Jewish Orthodox dynamics, right? There's an opposition, right, to computers and certain members of the community. So Rav Asher Weiss, on the one hand, wants to tell you that he knows people are ordering things online, but he doesn't want to endorse it for fear that someone might get offended. So he says, if you order things to your house by phone or other means, that's his way of aligning the, right? Exactly. That was what I thought. Carrier pigeon, right? Amazon pigeon, right? Fine. A drone, whatever. But anyway, establishing a set price is hard. He says, in a modern economy, it is accepted. Everyone sells at the price that is profitable for him. And the buyer is the one who scans the market to establish the price that works for him. Since this checking is incumbent on the buyer and not the seller, it is possible that it is as if they stipulated explicitly that this sale is on condition, that there is no prohibition of overcharging on me. Right, many products don't have a price at all, as the value of items changes, and it's new every morning based on supply and demand. On the other hand, and okay, we'll get to his last line in just a moment. Right, so Rusher Weiss just said, yeah, right, all of your intuitions that this all works when there's a price, but what is a price in 2017? He says that's exactly correct. All the laws of Onaah just don't apply nowadays because there's no price. What does it mean overcharge, underpay? You need a price as a benchmark to figure out whether it's above or below, but there is no above or below. Period. End of story. He does know there's one exception. The one exception, he says, is some things are basically price controlled. And he said things which are price controlled, so this is his novelty. He says not only do the laws of Onaah apply to things which are price controlled, they apply even more stringently. Because if the whole notion is, and we haven't really sort of fleshed this out, but the simplest understanding of why, when you overcharge someone less than a sixth, the sale stands, even if it's forbidden, is because most people will forgive it. We'll just relinquish that. We'll waive their rights, and they won't bother taking you to court for a 12th. And even the one person who wants to, forget about it. We just go by standard. Most people don't care up to a 6th. But if that's the assumption, that the reason an undercharge of less than a 6th, people just don't want to go to court for it. They don't want to force you. So what happens in a case where less than a 6th, everybody would get angry? For example, gas in Toronto, right? there's basically a set price. Basically, you go up and down, right? Basically, a set price within, right, 99% of the places sell exactly, and then some are 0.3 cents less or 1 cent less.
Big variations even within Toronto.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know when you go, like, all the way up. When I go up to, like, Rutherford and, like, Jane, the price goes down by 3 cents, right? But, or whatever. When I've gone, I don't know. Okay, good. I'll keep it in mind. But so a bad example. Okay, every gas station I've gone to here is basically the same price, right? But okay, fine. Or in his example, milk in Israel is price controlled. It's an exact price. It stays the same always, whatever it is, 5 shekel a bag, whatever it is, right? So he said in that case, if you charge an extra penny, right, you have to return it. Because if it's all about forgiveness, when people will waive their rights, no one waives their rights when there's a set price, a real, real, real set price. So Rusher Weiss says, for 99% of things, there's no such thing as a price. There are no overcharging, there's no nothing. If it's a real set price, and therefore I can look at you and say, I don't care if it was 10%, right, but I know you overcharged me, let's use the guess. Just we can argue about whether it's true in Toronto, but okay, fine. Right, whatever it is today, 111.9? A stamp, fine, a stamp. Right? If it's a, what are stamps these days? I don't know from the last time I mailed something. Whatever it is, 40 cents, I don't know. If I charge 42 cents for a stamp, right, people will get annoyed. So he says, most things, the laws of Onad don't apply. Things that have exact price, right, even less than 1/6, you got to return it. And that's, he said, that's the reality of the modern economy.
Is that because he's saying Onad is when people take offense?
Well, no, it's when they, meaning, when they won't forgive it, right? The less than 1/6 rule is because we assume they forgive it, right? As the Gemara says, it's derech limachel. People forgive that amount. So yeah, right? Offense is not the right word, but I'm going to leave it at offense, right? It's people won't insist on their rights, right? But people will insist on their rights, right? We know, right? Gas is a good example just because everyone wants that, you know, we'll go crazy for 5 cents off a gallon, right? How much is it saving you at the end of the day? But everyone is just looking for that, right? It feels good to save those few dollars, even though, right, we, you know, at the end of the day, it's still, right, still, even if it's a few cents less, it's still 105.9, right? It's still expensive. Fun. So that's one theory, is to say, look, the laws of overcharging, however they apply, they assume a price. There are no prices nowadays. Let's move on. At the other extreme, you have Shmuel Wozner, number 13, in his response to Shevet Alevi. He looks at the market, and he says, oh my, everyone is charging so much. T-shirts should be $10. They're charging $40. Everyone is violating the laws of overcharging. Woe is to us. Right? He assumes that the market has not changed, that the law has not changed, that there is an objective price. I can point to it. He doesn't explain what that price is, but he assumes there is an objective price out there, and the fact that a t-shirt costs $10 in Old Navy and $40 in Banana Republic tells you the Banana Republic are overcharging you. Period. End of story. That's it. What am I going to say? The fact that everybody knows that when they go in and they buy that same shirt, Banana Republic, too bad, right? He says everyone is violating it, that nothing has changed since the time of the Talmud. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg takes a middle possibility, and he says, I think there are prices. They're a bit more malleable. He says, what it probably is figure out, I'm not sure if he means average or median, right? But he thinks the price, there's a price range nowadays, right? And you got to figure out like the average or the median price and determine it from there. It might be a bit more malleable, right? So maybe, I don't know if the t-shirt costs $20 or $25, but if someone charges $60, then I know it's overcharging, right? So there's basically three possibilities, right? There are no prices nowadays on most things. There are exact prices, and how you would determine that, so there's different possibilities. Some say it's the cheapest price, some say it's the average price, some say it's the highest price. Right, the highest and lowest price, right? You know, pick some benchmark, or to say somewhere in the middle, right? That there are sort of prices nowadays, and we have to judge based on some sort of mix of, I don't know, the average and the median, right? So many times we won't be able to impose the law because, you know, if a t-shirt's normally $20 and some, you know, You know, someone charges you $24, $25, $26, you won't know if that's in the range or not, but if someone charges you $50, $60, you'll know it's overcharged. Okay? Right? That's basically the three possibilities.
And it's deceptively
overcharged. Yeah, obviously. All this is deceptive, right? If it's not deceptive, as we said, none of this applies. This is all deceptive overcharging. So
you could make the argument that between the three choices, maybe the last two opinions, they didn't want to sort of give up this concept of onerous fast that was in the Torah.
For sure.
So they didn't want to abandon it. But truth is, if the concept behind it was deception, lack of information, lack of available information, we don't want people, you know, vendors to prey on people's gullibility. And now we're living in a marketplace which is much more transparent.
Right, and that's exactly what Rabbi Weiss claims.
You know, then if you're really not walking away from onerous. We're not telling we're abandoning it. It just doesn't really. We've managed to fix the problem. They should be happy.
Right,
we've got a marketplace. Where
yeah.
There's much less gullibility.
Correct, and that's exactly what Rush or White said.
You don't need to rule really based. It's like, you know, if you're not commit murder, if there's no murder, nobody's going to complain. Well, let's keep the law.
Right. I mean, well, that's exactly what Rabbi Weiss says. Right. Weiss says, look, it's a buyer's market. Right. It's a seller's market. The buyer has to. Right, the buyer has to, you know, he has to use Flip. You don't want to use Flip, it's your problem, right? It's not so hard, right? Download the app, right? Right, you'll know what the prices are. It's your problem, especially stores that price match, right? They're telling you, it's your job. You don't want to show me the cheaper price. You don't want to use Flip? Don't use Flip, right? But, right, it's the responsibility. That's exactly what they're saying, right? Is the deception is gone. Everyone can do whatever they want, and therefore, you know.
Would the laws apply to vulnerable people?
For
example, you know, all these scams involved.
So obviously there are all types of other laws, right? There's theft, and there's, right, mekachtos, right? There are sales under mistaken premises, right? There are a whole bunch of other laws that prohibit, you know, preying on people, right? In addition to pricing, right? There's, you know, so those will still apply, right? If you're actually trying to... Correct. So pricing, now again... Correct, but if, again, it'll depend, right? If there are other potential issues, okay, so that could be involved, but it wouldn't necessarily be onah. So just to summarize what we have, is you have this, you know, law called onah, right? Don't deceptively overcharge, but it assumes a price. Then it hits the modern world, and you basically have, right, the authorities look at it. Some say, you know what, like Steve said, it's not, what can I do? I'm not getting rid of the law, it's just, there are no prices, right? For good or for bad? I would say for good, right? There's competition, right? And as many people point out, the reason you pay more for the shirt at Banana Republic isn't just because you're gullible. It's because it's a status symbol. So maybe you're paying for status. How exactly do you quantify status? It's not obvious how you quantify status. But maybe it really costs $40, right? You're paying $40 to say that I overpaid, right? I can afford to overpay, right? I'm wealthy enough that I can overpay, right? And there's something to that. So some poskim, like Rav Asher Weiss, just said, yeah, all this has to meet the modern market. In the modern market, that's not how things work. There are no prices for the most part, and therefore, the laws of overcharging just don't apply, right? Both because prices vary and because there's all this built-in status symbol and whatever it is, right? Convenience, right? We all know Metro costs a little bit more for some things, so it's open 24 hours, right? There's convenience built in. There's all types of things that are built in that change prices, and we know that, and we deal with it, and that's it. And then other poskim who aren't so ready to give up on the laws of overcharging, but then face a market where they got to figure out, okay, well, if I don't want to give up on it, what does it mean? And that's really hard. So then they suggest the lowest price, the average price, the median price, the highest and lowest bracket, right? And if you charge beyond what, you know, is within the normal range, it's overcharging. And they come up with different languages. But it's basically the fundamental question is halacha ready when it meets the realities of a modern market to say the reality is so drastically different that the law doesn't apply, or do we have to find a way of salvaging it, right? Rush Weiss says, no, you're not salvaging it. This is the reality. Razam Nechemia Goldberg somewhat, and Wasner in a more extreme way, saying, no, it applies as it always applied. Prices might be a bit more different to determine, but fundamentally the law still applies. Yeah.
Somebody's overcharging, and maybe just to say, well, this item is more expensive than something else, because there's more value added into it. So, for example, someone may pay $40 for a shirt at Banana Republic, but they're paying $40 because Banana Republic is giving away an umbrella with the shirt. Or maybe someone else will pay more money, but they're not, the vendor is not overcharging, but their refund policy is like a lifetime refund or a year.
Right.
So it's not that the item's over, the person's overcharging necessarily, but they're adding more value. So let's say
right.
I want to buy a car. So I want to buy a car that has, we can buy a car that has a maintenance package for 4 years, so, or the first 80,000 kilometers is built into the price of the car, but I want the maintenance package. I don't want to buy a car that's cheaper, that doesn't have a maintenance package attached to it, because the value added in the maintenance package is more worth it to me. So I'm not really being overcharged for the car. I'm not paying more money. I understand I'm getting more value.
Right, and I think that's, and I think that's part of it, right? I mean, part of the story is what Rusher Weiss said, which is that prices, you know, what's a price when you can buy from the, you know, global market? But the other part of it is, yeah, is that the market is also more complex, right? That, because it's not usually, it's sometimes the case that you're buying grapes at one store, you're buying grapes at the other store, the prices are different. But like I said, even, you know, at, let's say a place like Metro, right, or, you know, whatever, any 24-hour market, you know the price is slightly higher, but you go there because it's open 24 hours. They're not going to let you price match, right? You can come in 2 in the morning and you're going to price match, right, with a store that's closed, right? They're not going to let you do that. That's the whole point, is they charge, you're paying more for the value of being open 24 hours. If you come in at 7 o'clock in the afternoon, right, when you could have gone to No Frills, but you go into your 24-hour market, you're not going to come and say, well, I could go to that market, right, but I'm not price match. They'll say, so don't come here, right? We make most of our, you know, most of our business is at 11 o'clock at night and later. You're right. And whether it be warranty or refund policy or customer service, right, how many people, I forget, at some point there was a, at least in the States, there was a survey, right, of banks, right, which bank do you want? And I think it was Wachovia, right, that they knew that their rates were higher and people kept going because they said, but their service is so much better. I don't care if the rates are higher. I don't want to deal with the bad customer service at, you know, X, Y, and Z bank, and I'll pay the higher, you're right, right? The modern market, it's not just that you have the world to compare it to, it's also that what we're paying for is so complex, right? What we've introduced, whether, and like I said, with the Banana Republic, you're also, it's a status symbol, right? How do you put a price on status symbol? You don't. So I just want to note the last thing, because we're not going to get to read it inside. The one thing that does seem to apply nowadays, though, is not ona'ah, but it's hafkat she'arim. Right, the price gouging. Now the basics, and I'm just going to summarize it outside, is as follows. The Talmud feels as follows. Price manipulation is only a problem in essential items. Luxury items, we don't care if you manipulate prices, because we aren't out there to protect rich people from paying too much on luxury items. So for example, right, De Beers has a monopoly on diamonds, right? Diamonds are artificial, the prices are artificially drawn up. The Talmud could not care less. Right? You don't want to buy a $10,000 diamond, you know, piece of jewelry, so don't buy a $10,000 piece of jewelry. You want to? Go ahead. I don't care if De Beers is driving up the prices. It doesn't make anybody's life, right, better or worse, right? You've decided you want a diamond, go ahead. Right? Price manipulation doesn't apply to luxury items. It applies to essential items. Now, what is an essential item is a bit unclear, right? It's certain types of food are clearly essential items, and it's changed over time. It was one thing at the time of the Talmud, it's something else. But this law does apply, right? So just to give an example where everybody knows, right? This is an infamous example, right? Shartina gave Shonet, I think, last year, 2 years ago, was the Turing scandal, right? With the, right, what was it, this wasn't the EpiPen. It was the drug, I forget what it was for, or the EpiPen scandal, whichever one you want, right? The EpiPen scandal, right, where, you know, Turing bought the company, took the price, it used to be whatever it was, $50, and overnight it went up 750%, because now he had a monopoly on a life-saving drug, right? Now, you could say, well, there's no price, right? There's no price. I'm the only person on the market. I can charge whatever I want. You're right. It's not ona'ah. It's not overcharging. Right, you're the only person in the market. You're charging $750 for what yesterday was $50 for a life-saving drug. It is hafkat sharim, right? You did just gouge prices on an essential item, right? So while ona'ah may not apply because there aren't prices, it's clear that hafkat sharim does apply. And the basic law of hafkat sharim is you can't manipulate the price on essential items more than 20%. Now again, trying to figure out the exact price is a bit complicated, and that's the first half of this, you know, discussion. But in certain cases, when we know, right, I don't know if the price for the drug before was $50 or $60, but it wasn't $750, right, price gouging does apply, because price gouging, ona'a, applies to all items, right? Because I do care that if someone's buying a diamond ring, that they don't get cheated. I don't care if the price is too high, right? That's really the distinction, right? I don't want you to pay more than you think you should be, than you should be paying, but I don't care how much you should be paying. That's really, right, if you want to conceptualize it. So when this law of ona'a reaches the modern market, again, in the time of the Talmud, both laws applied. Nowadays, our markets, because of the global market we live in and because of added value for all types of things, I would tend to go with Rav Asher Weiss, though others have pushed back and say that it's very hard to actually say that the laws of ona'a applying nowadays and say there is a price. Our discussion on an ethical level shouldn't be as much about deceptive overcharging, because there isn't such a thing as overcharging. It's on things which are essential, right? What should the price be, and at what point do we have to, you know, swoop in? At what point do we encourage, like, I don't know, government intervention or whatever the case may be, right, to ensure that when things are essential, you don't gouge the prices on those? It may be that you're not overcharging because you've legitimately changed the price, but at what point do we obligate you to recognize that there are necessities in life and not to gouge the price on that? But that's really going to have to be a lecture for another time.
I just want to think about whether a cell phone is an essential.
So that's right. So we really have to wonder, right? How you would define it nowadays is really hard. Because, like, the example, right, just to give you an example, in the time of the Talmud, right, the Talmud assumes that like, bread, right, grain is an essential item. Eggs are borderline, and therefore you're allowed to raise the price by a full 100%. And anything more luxurious than an egg, right, there is no price control whatsoever, right? So the standard seems to be pretty, right, low, right, or pretty high, whichever way you're looking at it. But I think, you know, realistically, the discussion that really should be had, or that halacha can contribute in the modern economy, is less, you know, deceptive overcharging when prices are hard to set, is rather the question of under what circumstances we should be trying to control prices to keep essential items at a, you know, at a livable price, and in what cases do we not care. The laws of Hakad Sharim are as relevant as they always were, right, as is evident, right, if you follow, you know, in the States, this is, like I said, especially with medicine, this has become the ethical issue in, you know, Congress time and time again, just in the last few years, between, you know, especially the EpiPen issue, because there is, you know, even though we know that prices are malleable, we have an intuitive sense that things that are life-saving, right, shouldn't be a means by which you become rich on the backs of those who need it, right? And that's why there's been this ethical pushback, right, in it. So again, that's going to have to be discussion for another time, but I think that's the conversation more that we could have in light of Jewish business ethics, less, you know, the question of overcharging, and more the question of what things are essential such that we shouldn't allow people to drive the prices up, even if once they've driven it up, we'll have no recourse to force them to bring it down. Okay.